You're listening to the Just One Outdoors Podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Just One Outdoors Podcast. Today, we've got an awesome guest, someone that we're meeting for the first time, excited to get to chat with, excited to get to know a little bit about. Trevor, welcome to the podcast, man, and appreciate you enduring our technical difficulties. Like I said, kind of before we hopped on here, you were the unfortunate guinea pig, so we appreciate your patience.
Yeah, no problem at all. I'm super excited to be here. Thank you so much for the invite.
Yeah, man. So go ahead and tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, so I'm Trevor Hubbs. I am the manager of the Armed Forces Initiative of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, which is a mouthful. But basically, our organization's a 501c3 dedicated to public land, water, and wildlife access. And I run the division of that larger nonprofit that focuses on the military and veteran community, teaching them how to hunt, how to fish, and how to trap, just kind of the outdoors.
That's really cool. I think there's a lot of guys that want to get outdoors, whether it's a vet or just someone else, and they just don't know how. So I think that's really cool. What kind of things do you do to kind of get the veterans outdoors and teach them how to hunt or fish or whatever it might be?
Sure. So we do what we call dual skills camp, which is the two skills being taught are how to hunt or fish and why to hunt or fish. So, I mean, we've done camps all over the country. Last year we did, I think it was like 146 for 2024. Wow. We have 187 scheduled, just about 2,800, a little over 2,800 available slots for participants. So, but yeah, we do like fly fishing in Montana. We've done bear hunts in Colorado, caribou hunts in Alaska, saltwater fishing we have coming up actually later this spring in South Carolina, upland hunts on the prairie. Like, the goal is that you come to our events and you learn just enough or have just enough experiences to where you could go repeat the good times you had outdoors, either the next season or the next weekend, depending on what's going on. And you don't have to depend on anyone or any group to take you anymore because you have all the skill sets needed, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. What demographic do you find most of the people come to your camps? What demographic group do they typically fall in?
That's something we've started monitoring pretty recently just because there's so many federal grants out there to take people hunting and fishing, but most of those grants are directed in like the diversity, equity, and inclusion sector, so we've kind of had to come up with some numbers. So we started doing these surveys I'd say like February of last year, almost a year from today. Turns out we were within 3 to 5% of the active duty military demographic. So right now we're at like 22% African American, like 17 or 18% Hispanic, about 12% female. I guess primarily though it's Caucasian white people.
Sure.
Dudes.
Mm-hmm. So that was a good segue into another question I had. Where you guys are a nonprofit, where does your guys' funding come from? Is it private? Is it grants, like you mentioned? Is it kind of a mix?
No. So right now, we have a couple of grants that are coming from private, like private companies. So like our biggest funder right now is Veterans United, and then right behind them is FHF Gear, which is one of the companies under the Meat Eater First Light family of companies. Yeah. We've applied for a lot of federal grants. We haven't been super successful. Cabela's is another one of our big funders. They'd be mad if I didn't mention them. But and the reason for it is there's a lot of programs, like grants from the government that are focused on, like, well, this is for veterans therapy. And then there's a lot of grants that are like, well, this is for conservation. Mm-hmm. And we, like, kind of play in both worlds, right? So, yeah. Like, I'm creating more hunters and anglers. We're talking about Pittman Roberts at these camps. We're talking about where your hunting license dollars go, what you can do and how to use your voice as a veteran or active duty military member to protect these pastimes, these sports, whatever you want to call them, these activities and these wild places and wild things. Right. So we're definitely playing in both fields, and there's just not, I think that confuses a lot of these, grant organizations within the government, like the VA or Department of Interior, because they're like, well, you don't quite fit into the conservation grant, but you also don't really fit into this like therapy grant pool for veterans. So they're not really sure what to do with us. We were told like 3 or 4 years ago that we needed more of a sample size to prove our concept by the Department of Veteran Affairs. That was when we were doing about 200 people a year. We just hit the 6,000th participant mark, which puts us, I mean, right up there, top three for what we do is technically called adjunct outdoor therapy for veterans. That's the VA term. But, yeah, with 6,000 people, it's going to be almost 9,000 people by the end of this year. We're right up there with, like, the big three. So Project Healing Waters, Warriors in Quiet Waters is another one, Ridges to Recovery. But I'd say we're in top three to top five, just based on number of participants.
That's awesome. So how does a vet become a participant of, say, a bear hunt in Colorado? What does that process look like?
Yeah, so that's been something that I'm working on this year more and more. Is really just kind of our biggest weakness right now is marketing. So we have a website. We list all of our events on the website. Just as soon as I have enough details to do so, the who, what, why, where, how kind of deal. Mm-hmm. So veterans sign up. On average, we get about 50 applicants per event. And then normally we could take 10 to 15 just based on resources we have. So like some of the events we could take more, like duck hunts or pheasant hunts, we could take more just because one mentor can take, you know, three hunters, and that's a comfortable, safe environment. But if it's a big game hunt or a turkey hunt, you don't really want more than a one-on-one mentor-to-mentee ratio, and that kind of burns some of our guys out. You have them do less of them. But basically, they go on the website, fill out a short application, basically, who are you, what do you do? I go do, like, a little quick background check just to keep everybody safe, especially if we're handing out firearms and stuff.
Yeah.
And then we kind of make a call, like, who needs it more, who needs the experience, who doesn't, or who would be better suited for another experience. Like, if this guy's really interested or this girl's really interested in, like, a learn to hunt for cooking purposes, I don't necessarily want to send them to this, bow fishing event. I would rather send them to this turkey hunt or this event that's, you know, 120 to 90 miles away.
Right.
Like later in the year. So just try and balance that all out. And we're not experts. I mean, I got my degree in business. I'd never run a nonprofit before a couple of years ago. So we're figuring it out.
Gotcha. So I have a couple questions going off that, completely unrelated questions. But the first one is, you mentioned the mentors, the mentees. Is your organization providing like the mentor, or are you going through a guide service, or what does that look like?
Yeah, so every now and then we do have, like if we have a designated grant or a, like we just had a private donor, that's a bad example. So let's say we have a private donor and says, hey, I want to give you guys a slot at my duck camp for 8 people, right? 2 pit blinds for the people on this date. Well, then we'll use whatever that, like private duck club's guide or whatever they want to say, and that'll be the mentor to teach us. But we actually have better results, which about 95% of our camps are just volunteer mentors. So these are cool. PHA members, or normally they're also veterans, active duty military, but not necessarily. And they come in and they take either 1, 2, or at the most 3 participants. And their job in the field is to go through, like, we have a lot of how-to turkey hunt camps coming up. So during the day, they're going to wake up. They're going to talk about, like, hey, here's the toms are on the roost right now. We're going to try and gobble or hen call. They're going to gobble back. We're going to locate them. We're going to try to set up in about a quarter mile of that roost and explain kind of the how of turkey hunting, like what a sign looks like, how to call, why we're using shotguns, that kind of deal. Mm-hmm. Then in the evening, the participants, the mentors, they're going to come back. They're going to have dinner, and we're going to have a nice conversation. Like it's presentation is a strong word because we're normally around a campfire, you know?
Yeah.
Just a conversation about, hey, this is where turkeys were in, you know, 1850 or 1868 or whatever, when they were at historic lows. Mm-hmm. And this is where they're at today. And those come from these reintroduction efforts and this money that comes from something called the Pittman-Robertson Act. And that fits into the North American model of wildlife conservation, because we as hunters are engaging in this natural process and paying for the restoration and conservation of all these different species. So ideally during the day, they learn how to hunt. And during the evenings, they learn why to hunt. And nobody's going to be an expert, right? Like, but they come, the idea being they leave this and maybe they get so just ate up and enamored with turkey hunting that they have to do it, that they become so passionate that when a turkey bill comes around in North Carolina that wants to limit tags from 2 to 1 or some sort of bill that would not necessarily be good for conservation or good for hunters and anglers, they have the wherewithal to speak up at that natural resources meeting or whatever it is and say, as a veteran, I like turkey hunting because of this, this, and this, and this is why it plays into conservation, kind of defend sport a little better, defend the activity, if that makes sense. Yeah,
absolutely. So my other question, kind of going off of that, was is this like you apply, you get on, say, a bear hunt, can you apply for others after that? Or is this like you get on the bear hunt, now you can't apply anymore?
No, you can absolutely continue to apply. There's no such thing as a hard and fast rule, I've decided, but you'll have to have a really good reason to be a participant at more than three.
Gotcha. Right?
So what we normally see is you'll come out to one, maybe that didn't go well, maybe you're just too new, you didn't really learn enough, you want to go to another one about 6 months later, totally cool. Let's bring you out, let's teach you. I could be sold on doing that again, but what I want to avoid is just like, it's not the right, it's not
like the same group going again and again, yeah.
Like a good old boys club or just the same people going over and over, because again, the theory is to teach. So what we normally see, about 57% of applicants do come to another camp, but they come as a camp chef or a photographer or as a writer or some other support position or even a mentor. Come back and help other people in the military community learn how to do this. Like, we very rarely have people come back as a participant more than once.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's neat. It's cool, too, that you guys take really like a holistic approach when you're not just teaching people how to do it, but teaching people why. I think that's pretty awesome. So you mentioned sort of the camp atmosphere. I think that's a really awesome piece that you guys have going on. Do most of the camps that you guys put on have that sort of overnight feel? Does it kind of just depend on what type of activity it is?
It depends on the type of activity and depends on the time of our mentors. I mean, it's a nonprofit, so you should expect us to be on a shoestring budget, and we are. But it's I personally was not prepared for the amount of shoestring in this budget. Like, it's rough. But so what we have found is like the 3 to 4 day is kind of the ideal. 5 days will do them, but anything past that, and you got people taking, you know, 7 or 8 days vacation, depending on travel, depending on if they have to rest afterwards to go back to like a physically demanding job or whatever, right? So that 3 to 4 day is really the sweet spot, but we find ourselves doing more and more single day events, which they're good. You don't get as much out of a single day as you would out of 3 days. But so if I were to say, hey, meet at this gas station at 3 in the morning, we're going to meet at the gas station. I'll buy everybody a sandwich and a coffee, do a quick little, what is BHA? What is AFI? What are we doing here? Let's go to the boat ramp, put the boat in. Let's go duck hunting for the morning. Get out of the marsh at like 2 p.m. and meet with whatever, stick with North Carolina, the North Carolina Region 8 waterfowl biologist, who's going to have lunch with us and explain, like, kind of talk through everything we just saw. Oh, we saw a lot of canvasbacks. Well, you see those this time of year because of X, Y, Z, and this plant helps or hurts them and all this stuff, right? So you can still get a lot out of a one-day event, but the three-day events are good. Like, let's stay with that waterfowl example. We just did a three-day event in Oklahoma, where you have three different mentors. They're each taking out three people a day, and it's three different people. So we had one mentor, their job was like layout blind field geese. Like, hey, we're going to set, you know, probably 10 dozen decoys I think they had. We're going to set layout blinds. We're going to talk about camouflage. We're going to talk about decoy tactics. We're going to talk about goose calling versus duck calling. Then the next day, those three go and stand in the timber with me, and now we're talking about what water depth we're looking for, how to identify ducks in the timber and the shadows, how to call them in. They just get a very different hunting experience. Then the third day, we'll do like a big water diver spread with a third mentor. So these 9 participants kind of drift around, and in 3 days, they've seen 3 very different kinds of waterfowl hunting, and they've experienced it all. They've participated in the setup. They've participated in the calling. So they understand, you know, maybe there's something they're super into. Maybe there's something they're not. Maybe they just want to go do all of them again. I don't know, you know?
Yeah, that sounds really cool. What, like, generally, what kind of feedback do you get from people? What kind of do they look back and say, hey, this was the best part? Was it the learning how? Was it the learning why? Maybe it was, you know, getting to connect with other veterans. I'm curious if there's, like, a general consensus from the people who are coming to these about the experience.
I would say it's split. I mean, most, I wouldn't say most. At every event, we get some people that during the like we send a survey out afterwards that will tell you, like, the most important part was that you're in a camp atmosphere with other veterans who have all done through like the same type of struggles. They've all had the same life experience. It's just a really safe way to talk about stuff that folks haven't talked about in years. And even if they don't talk, there's just a certain sense of belonging. Let's call it that you get in the military that you just lose when you get out. So coming to these camps and being with other folks really seems to help people. The other one is the learning how, which also plays into like the group of veterans. Is as an adult, it's much easier to learn when you could form that immediate trust with your mentor, with the other mentees, the other participants, because you've all served for the past 20 years. We've been at war, right? Like everybody immediately has something in common. Very willing to learn, very willing to teach, very willing to help. The negative comments that we've gotten, we consistently get that we don't serve enough vegetables as the food, which is completely on me. That's my fault. And we are changing it.
If you've been to a camp and
we didn't have vegetables, like I'm getting the pre-made salad mixes as part of the shopping list. So that's the count. But also, like, if that's the negative feedback we're getting, we're doing a pretty good job. Like, not saying we're not going to address it, but
sure,
it's pretty good negative feedback.
I mean, out of everything you're doing, for someone to say, yeah, you need more vegetables, I feel like they're struggling to find, like, a negative feedback to give. It's like, more vegetables.
Yeah.
Man.
Which is fun.
Oh, yeah.
Buzzard Roost Saddles, made right here in the great state of Louisiana, should be on every Louisiana bow hunter's list as a must-have in their hunting arsenal. Buzzard Roost Saddles achieves comfort through adjustability for those long day sets during the rut and also provides the maneuverability to get up and move when you see the need. Buzzard Roost Saddles was created with the need to lighten the piro as well as the backpack to go deeper than everyone else. Louisiana bow hunters are a mixed bag, and Buzzard Roost Saddles is the tool to fit any job. Whether it's public land, private land, hardwoods, pines, or even the bottomless swamps, Buzzard Roost Saddles has what you need to stay mobile.
So I'm curious, you know, we encounter a lot of people through just daily life who, one, either have never been hunting, don't know anything about hunting, have a lot of questions, or two, have been hunting when they were younger or have been before and would like to get back into it or things like that. So I'm curious, with the people coming to your events, are you finding it's more like people who have been before, maybe when they were young with their dad and just stopped, or is it newbies who have never been hunting and want to try it out?
Yeah, it's about 70% people that grew up in a hunting family or like hunting adjacent, as some folks call it. But then didn't hunt the entire time they were in the military. Like, and I'm in that boat. The whole 8 years I was in, I didn't really hunt just because, what, you're busy. Yeah. One, like, I will take this example. It's you'll be Private Jones, and you grew up in the Ozarks of Missouri. You join the infantry right out of high school. You end up at Fort Benning, Georgia, but that's your basic training in your airborne school, so you're not really hunting there because you have no time. And that's 6 months of your life. Then you get sent to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. You're at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where now you have like brook trout fishing. There's no real like brook trout in Missouri. You have hog hunting where you can hog hunt down there. You can, there's saltwater fishing that's super close. You can go, you know, 3 hours down the road and you'd be catching redfish or flounder, all this other cool stuff. So, but you don't know that because you've never been to North Carolina. You only grew up in Missouri. So even if, your boss who yells at you every day, even if you got up the courage to ask your boss, hey, do you know where I'd be able to go hunting and fishing around here? That guy got there about 6 months before you did, and he has no idea. And then you have, you know, your year of deployment, year of training, year of rest, year of deployment, year of training, year of rest. You're constantly on that cycle for your whole career. And before you knew it, you're out of the military, and it turns out you haven't hunted for 15, 20 years. So there's folks that like, man, I want to get back into this. But then especially on like the infantry or some of those combat arms guys, it's, man, I've seen this movie. I've done the whole carrying a gun around in the woods. It's not that fun. It becomes work because that's what you did in the military.
Yeah.
So it takes a little bit of pushing to kind of, you know, kick people out of the house a little bit and show them like, hey, the sleeping on the ground thing can be all right. Like, it doesn't have to be terrible. a lot more fun when there's nobody shooting at you.
Yeah, probably. Unless you're on public land, I mean, then you might have someone shooting at you.
Yeah.
No. That's go ahead.
Oh yeah, I just wanted to ask a little bit about the organization as a whole. It seems like there's a lot going on, a lot to coordinate. How many people do you guys have internally just working on, you know, getting camps going, getting food prepped, getting mentors? It seems like this would be a lot of coordinating, a lot of moving pieces. How many people you guys have working for you?
I'm glad you pointed that out, because nobody thinks about that. It's just me. I am the only staffer. We have a lot of volunteers that make it happen and take time out of their day, out of their own schedule, to make sure that our program is all the organization that it needs to be successful. But as far as staff, it's just me.
Man.
Ooh. You have a lot on your plate.
I've never worked harder for less money other than when I was in the military.
So how did you get connected? How did this kind of all play out for you?
Yeah, so a couple, like, and the military is one really big small town. Everybody knows somebody who knows somebody else, and me and four other folks that were all BHA members, we all had gotten out and had somehow found our way back to hunting and fishing. We're all sort of not with a nonprofit or anything, just taking people out, like, oh yeah, man, if you're going to be down here, let's go do this. Like, people, other veterans, people that we were in the military with personally, just kind of trying to teach them stuff. And we all happen to be BHA members. BHA decides they want to focus on the military community. And we kind of got tapped as volunteers, like, hey, let's try this program out, build it, see what it looks like, see if this idea has legs, if it's sustainable, what can we do? So the four of us got together and started planning kind of larger scale events. And we did our first event in 2020, November in Eastern Montana, where we took folks on a doe mule deer hunt. Those were the over the counter tags, just kind of taught like spot and stalk, what is glassing, like how to prep a mule deer hindquarter after you've killed it, like some great recipes. And it went really well. We did that camp for 18 people. And that was our first like 18 members. Those are who we kind of built our base off of. And next thing comes, we get a bunch more funding. People want to donate and get to the point where the CEO of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, the old CEO, we just got a new one, but he says, hey, we need to bring somebody on full time. And he asked me to take the job. And I took it. I mean, honestly, any of those four guys could have done this, but it's a pretty significant pay cut that I wouldn't necessarily wish on folks. But anyway, I wished it on myself and I took the job and been doing this ever since.
That's awesome. So tell us a little bit about your hunting background, if there is one.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up very fortunate. My dad is an avid waterfowler, so I was, you know, in the duck blind, before I even had waders or boots or anything. As long as I could fit in a backpack, I was going. And dad really enjoyed that. Then I had an uncle that was really into kind of bird dog, the upland game. And I grew up in Southern Illinois when we still had quail. So I got to learn about, like, not only labs and the duck blind, but pointers and Britneys and all these other kind of, this other brand of bird hunting, which I really liked. And then I had another uncle, my mom's brother, who was really into running hounds after coons and coyotes and had everything. So I'd go with him and we'd run trap lines and go chase whatever fur bearers were in season and have a good time. So I kind of got to see every piece of what you can do in Southern Illinois, I guess. Like, I didn't hunt in the West until I was 2017, 2018, I guess.
What part of Illinois?
It's like the bottom. You know where like Carbondale is, Southern Illinois University, about an hour west of there.
Okay.
Like towards the Mississippi River.
Gotcha. My parents are both from Quincy, Illinois.
Oh, yeah. So like right up there, just north of St. Louis.
Yep. That a couple hours north of St. Louis, that's where I kind of learned how to waterfowl hunt, is right there on the Mississippi.
Yeah, so, well, that's right where the Missouri comes in, too. And then you have the Illinois River right above you. It's probably a pretty good area.
It was back then. Nowadays, there's not enough snow up north to push the birds down.
I think that was the season for everybody. It was rough. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I just got into, we're in Southwest Missouri, the Ozarks of Missouri.
Yeah.
And we, I just got into waterfowl this year, literally 2024. And we had our best day duck hunting today, and we have two days left in season. And it's just like, well, this kind of stinks.
Yeah, it's been rough. I mean, the Missouri Northern Zone closed like the first week of January, and I was coming back from hosting an event in Oklahoma, coming back through up 44. And when I crossed the Missouri River, I stopped and got the binos out and looked. I would estimate there was 500,000 ducks just sitting right there under the bridge, and the season had been closed for 2 weeks up there.
Yeah, sounds about right.
It's crazy.
That 500,000, I don't think has even made it to our neck of the woods yet, based on some reports I've heard. But anyways, I was curious about the Illinois thing. I'm on your website and I've looking. I'm looking at the chapters. Do you have chapters in all 50 states?
So technically BHA has chapters in 49 states. We're missing Hawaii. And gotcha. Then the Armed Forces Initiative, we have a, like we're supposed to call them detachments now, because there's like a legal designation with chapters where as backcountry anglers can have multiple chapters. But anyway, so we have detachments is what we're calling them. So we have detachments in 46 states, and then we're on 37 active duty military installations.
Okay. Huh. It's just cool looking at this and seeing. I mean, I'd heard of BHA, but I didn't realize it was so big. Like, there's
it's a
lot going on.
It's a thing. Also, appreciate you not pointing out those spelling errors. I know they're on there for anybody who's listening. Had a graphic designer do the stuff, and the spelling errors are like embedded in the pictures, and I don't know how to redo the pictures, and I would rather have misspelled words and good pictures than no pictures and properly spelled words. So we're just going to deal with it.
I mean, to be fair, I haven't found them. And now that you're saying it, I'm trying to find them. I still can't find them. So
good. That makes me happy. To be honest, the graphic designer asked me, he's like, hey, does this look good? And I didn't catch them for like 4 months. And then, anyway, life happens.
Oh, yeah.
We've all heard the saying, a picture tells a thousand words, and the same can be said for deer mounts. A skull on the wall represents so much more than just a successful hunt. It represents the culmination of lots of work, some luck, and rich memories with friends and family. At Just One, we like to hang our skulls with skull hangers from Kibosh Outdoors. The hangers are secure, super easy to set up, and made in the U.S. They even have hangers for as little as $9 to get your skull sitting proudly at the perfect angle. Go check them out at KiboshOutdoors.com or follow the link in our bios and use code JUSTONE at checkout to save 10% on your order.
So you kind of mentioned that you had just come back from an event recently. How many events do you go to a year?
So the past 2 years, my job has been grow the program, introduce this to as many veterans and many active military folks as I can. And how I did that was physically get it on the road and training volunteer leaders, volunteer mentors, and how to put these camps together and kind of teach them in a very hands-on way how to do this in a way that's replicable, sustainable, and above all, budget-friendly. Well, let's see. I was on the road 227 days in 2022 and 2023, on the road about 177 days. Wow. So far this year, I've only been on the road 10 days, and I'm really hoping that sticks. Because I'm trying to take on more of like an admin, fundraising, like big picture stuff, and let the day to day be managed by the local folks.
Do you guys have any events in the Southwest Missouri area?
I know we have some like introduction to fly fishing, the Ozark events coming up this spring. Trying to get some turkey stuff events together. We've had a couple offers from some other like partner. We run into a lot of partner nonprofits. Or like similar mission nonprofits to try to help us out, and it hasn't necessarily worked out. Like, they've been okay events, but there's always just one or two differences where it just feels like Like that organization got 20 grand from the VA to do an event and then couldn't figure out how to put the event together. So they have us put the event together and they pay for everything. But then like, I know that we spent 4 grand on that event. Where did that other 16 grand go? It went to them to pay their staff and their insurance and all that stuff, which I get it is fine, but we could skip a step and the VA could just give me that 20 grand.
Yeah, that's fair.
So
right on.
Yeah, you might have mentioned already, but how long have you been in this position?
Since 2020, the end of 2020. I've been a full-time staff person.
And how can people get involved with what you're doing and support what you're doing?
I mean, the best way, honestly, is still to either email me or email Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. So me is just my last name, H-U-B-B-S, at backcountryhunters.org. You could also just email Armed Forces Initiative, all spelled out, at backcountryhunters.org, or just admin at backcountryhunters.org. It's all going to get back to me again. It's just me. The email kind of just lets me sort stuff according to priority. But there's also, if you go to the website, there's like a list of contacts by state, contacts by installation. Like if you know, like, hey, I'm getting transferred to Fort Knox at the end of the year and I'd love to get involved in something like this, well, we have a Fort Knox club over there. Here's his email. It's just, I think it's just Fort Knox AFI at backcountryhunters.org. Like, try and keep him pretty simple. Reach out to him directly. His name is David Spetz. He's a great dude. Same with like Alaska, Idaho. All the states are just the state initials, then AFI at backcountryhunters.org. So Illinois is ILAFI, backcountryhunters.org. MOAFI at backcountryhunters.org for Missouri, and so on.
So, for example, if you've got an elk hunt out west, what all is on the response? What's the responsibility of the person who's coming out to hunt? So, you've kind of mentioned that food is covered. What does lodging look like? What does, whatever weapon they're going to be hunting with? What about tags? I guess where's that line between the responsibility of the person who's selected and coming out to do the hunt or the fish or whatever it is?
Yeah. So except in very limited circumstances, our insurance will not let us pay for travel to an event or pay for hunting license and tax. Everything else, like you got to tell me, but really you could show up in jeans and a t-shirt and we'll figure the rest out for you. But you got to buy your own hunting license. You got to buy your own, transportation to the event.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, and awesome. The theory behind that is like plane crashes or you get in a car crash and we paid for that gas or whatever, then we're liable. And I get it. It's those insurance lawyers, they know what they're talking about. So, keeping me safe.
They know how to get their money.
Yeah.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
This is more just something I'm interested in. There are obviously like a wide array of different things that you guys offer. Is there an event or a camp or maybe a couple that are coveted compared to the rest? I mean, is there something that you guys get a lot of applicants for and there just seems to be a lot of interest in, or is it really just a mixed bag kind of depending on where the camp is geographically?
Well, so, I mean, I've been looking at that, and we've had a couple theories, and every time we make a theory, like the board and me trying to like, wow, this is really going well. I think this is going to be a big hit. We launch it, like our theory always gets proven wrong because it just bounces around. Like it's wild. I mean, obviously, we did like a how to hunt caribou last year because a ton of folks get stationed up in Alaska, and they spend 4 years there, and they don't hunt when a caribou tag's $5, right? So trying to get a bunch of folks that just got stationed up there, like, hey, this is pretty simple to go do. Like, it's really not that bad. That one got a ton of applicants. And we do, like, a fly fishing on the Yellowstone River every other year. That one usually gets a ton of applicants. But we've also been super surprised where, like, we'll put together what we think is an amazing opportunity, and we'll get, like, 15 applicants for 10 spaces. So it depends. I guess that just shows that I really don't know what's exciting to other people. I know what's exciting to me. I know what some of the members of the board is exciting, but it just depends. And honestly, that's a lot of that's just like whatever outdoor media or hunting media is on TV at the time.
Sure.
Like, I mean, folks always want to elk hunt. They always want to mule deer hunt and do some crazy special stuff like that. But most of our participants are also like just trying to get into it. Like our turkey events are always very really packed. But I think that's just because it's such a friendly way to get started hunting, right? Like once you get the bird on the ground, it's all so familiar. You just buy this same meat at the store. You know what to do with it. You know how to cook it. You're not going to try and like sell it to your kids or hide it in something like when you're cooking it, you know?
Yeah. It's a really good introduction into the hunting world because like you get a deer and you go, well, like for example, I killed an elk this year and I looked at my buddy and you know, I've gutted deer. I've cleaned deer. I've, you know, done all that. I've quartered out deer. But then you get to an elk and I looked at him and I go, dude, where do I even start on this thing? It's so big. I don't know what to do. So I think turkey, absolutely. What was that?
Absolutely. You're 100% correct. I've been in the same position.
So a turkey, it makes sense that, you know, you could hand someone a full turkey and they'd probably be able to figure it out pretty easily just because, you know, they've dealt with them before, even though they're store bought.
Yeah. So the turkey ones always go well. A lot of the fishing ones fill up really quick. We also have to remember, like, we don't do like hunts of a lifetime. Like there's a lot of organizations out there that'll do like free 60 inch moose hunt for a veteran or 300 something inch elk, like these once in a lifetime kind of stuff. Like just everybody on the board, myself, I just hate that term once in a lifetime. Especially given our mission, like it's not my job to take somebody hunting one time and they're, even if they have an amazing experience, like that's cool. What did you do since then? Like if anybody leaves one of our events and says, yeah, I went hunting 5 years ago, it was great. I've failed. Like the goal is how can I teach you to do something that you can go again the next weekend, again the next season, that you can realistically keep doing. So yeah. Like we don't offer a lot of these just huge, like massive kind of like tags or governor's tags or crazy like sheep or mule deer hunts. Like not taking anything away from it. That's just not our mission. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like you guys are doing kind of the opposite of that where it's like, hey, we'll take you on this. Like that is like, we'll take you on this one hunt. You'll guaranteed kill, yada, yada. This is more of a, you know, we're going to get you into hunting. And our goal is to almost not have you come back to this event because we've taught you what you need to go do it yourself, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. And then also like we did that event, our first event ever in Eastern Montana was doe mule deer. You just don't get people coming out of the woodwork to sign up for doe mule deer. Like you get folks that want to learn how to, and they're kind of looking for that once in a lifetime or massive buck experience, like they're going to go somewhere else. They're looking at other stuff. Our sectors don't necessarily cross there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think this is sort of a good segue as we kind of get in toward the end here. You mentioned your mission, which is, you know, being able to teach someone how to replicate whatever skills you're teaching them at the camp. What metrics, if any, do you guys have to measure the success? Is it based on the survey? Is it based on hearing back from people, do you guys have any way of measuring, okay, this is who came, this is what we taught them, a year later, 2 years later, they're out there
doing
it?
Yeah, so we have a separate 18-month survey that we don't get as many responses on. Out of 6,000 participants, so we only have about 1,800 responses, which is good, like,
yeah, that's industry, not bad. Like,
looking at survey responses, but it's not, you know, it's not 6,000. But according to those responses, 1,800 is not a lot. I get that. But according to those responses, 87.7% of attendees have gone hunting or fishing again since they went to our event. And if we leave that as like, that's the lowest measure of kind of building a conservationist, is did they continue to buy a license that pays into the North American Mile of Wildlife Conservation, right?
Yeah.
So 87% of our participants do go ahead and go hunting or fishing again. They buy a license again. Now, we also learned through that survey that on average, our participants spend about $600 on outdoor gear after attending an event, which shows me that they're, you know, $600 worth of passion about this thing. Like we've sparked something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's also helpful with corporate sponsors. I can tell you, I'm making whatever, 2,800 new customers a year that are all going to go spend $600.
Yeah, that's a pretty handy metric to have there.
Yeah.
And I think it's cool to show, like, I mean, people aren't just going to, like, $100 is a big deal to some people. And some people are going out and going, $600 for, you know, that's a complete set of camo and probably a weapon of some sort.
So. Oh, absolutely. It's well, what we've learned is people will, who don't know, like, they're super familiar with, like, an Army weapon system or everything the Army uses, but they don't know about this particular thing, like, they're going to go into it. If you show them a good time, they're going to really get into it. Give you an example. We did a waterfowl hunt. This is in, like, on the Yellowstone River in Montana. And had some good days, like, doing, like, field hunting right off the river, mallards and Canada geese, and showed these guys a pretty amazing time, but had never done a duck hunt or waterfowl hunted before.
Mm-hmm.
Get to the end, like, hey, I really want to get into this. What kind of gun do you have? And I was like, well, I'm shooting a Benelli Super Black Eagle, but if you really want to get into this, you should buy a Remington 870, like $250 on Black Friday, which is coming up. Like, you can beat the hell out of it. It'll be fine. And if you decide you're really into this, maybe later get something good. All nine of them came back with Super Black Eagle 3s the next, like, 3 weeks.
Dang.
A $1,600 shot. And if you show them a good time, like, the cost doesn't necessarily become an option. Like, they're so ready to be passionate about something and to get involved with something that they're just going to go.
That's awesome. So as we wrap up here, we do a final segment called Around Our Campfire. And I think it's fitting that, you know, you mentioned earlier sitting around a campfire talking, you know, talking about whatever it might be, teaching or whatever it is. What is that piece of advice that you tend to say at your camps around the campfire to the guys who are just getting into it? What are you saying to them?
Oh man, that's a great question. And honestly, I don't think I'm going to have a super fancy answer for you. My stuff is mostly based on safety. And honestly, I'm looking at, like, the next 16 hours at those campfires. Like, what are we going to do tomorrow that is going to keep people safe? And that's, usually just comes down to firearm safety. And honestly, just take your time. Whether it's a fly fishing class or a hunting class or a trapping class, like, there's 100 reasons why you should be rushing. You're cold, you're wet, you're tired, whatever. If you take your time, you're going to have a better result there at the end. So just,
yeah. I don't think that's a piece of advice we've got before, but I like it.
Yeah.
Cause I think take your time can apply to safety. It can also apply to hunting when you draw back on a deer or an elk or whatever it might be, and even waterfowl when you're, you know, trying to get on that bird. Just take your time. I mean, obviously you don't have all day, but, like, if you rush it, you're probably going to miss. I know from experience.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, things could turn south, and I make the same mistake that I tell people not to make. I mean, heck, I made it this morning. So here in about an hour, I'm getting ready to do a virtual, like, trapping 101 class.
Mm-hmm.
Just we're trying to do that this year to, like, kind of spread the word on what you would learn at our events. Like, so instead of teaching 10 people, I'm going to teach 50 people all at once, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, so I'm out on the trap line this morning checking stuff, and I know I've got a 9:30 a.m. call, and I'm walking 4 miles downriver, 4 miles upriver. I've got 3 hours to do it, but the ice is getting pretty sketchy, and I know I can go faster on the ice than I can through the foot of snow we have up here. And anyway, made a decision to go out on the ice, fell through a couple times, ended up taking just as long, cold, wet, miserable, ended up snapping my hand in the trap because I was rushing. Like,
oof.
Take your time, do it right. Like, you're going to be better off. You're going to set better traps. You're going to be more conscious about what you're doing.
Yeah.
You're going to have better results.
I think that's a good piece of advice. So we'll go ahead and wrap this one up. We really appreciate you being on, taking the time out of your night to share about BHA and the Armed Forces Initiative. Man, that is a long, like, tongue twister.
Yeah.
But we really appreciate it and really find it cool what you are doing. How can our listeners find you on social media, get involved, and all of that?
Yeah, the biggest way would be just, like, Instagram, BHA_AFI. I think it's the same thing on Facebook. and then just head over to the BHA website, click on Programs, Armed Forces Initiative. We'll take you right to our little page, and you can see our events. You can reach out to me, whatever you need. You also follow me on Instagram if you want to, just Trevor Hubs. It's easy. I'm not very imaginative.
Do you post any pictures of your hand after it gets caught in traps?
I'm about to trap my hand in a trap like live tonight on this class. So and that'll go on YouTube. It's better to do it. I tell people to do that because it's going to happen in the field because you're going to be cold, you're going to be tired, you're going to be slippery. Might as well get to know what it feels in a controlled environment first so you know what you're ready for. Can't expect to do it in the field and get yourself out of that trap if you can't do it in your basement or in your garage.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. Well, I'll definitely be keeping an eye out on YouTube.
All right. Sounds good, guys.
All right, Trevor. Thank you again so much for your time. It was awesome getting to hear about everything that you're doing. We know that you've got a lot on your plate, a lot on your shoulders, but we appreciate it. We think it's a great mission. And again, just thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it, guys. Every little bit helps spread the word. So thank you.
Yep. All righty, guys. Thank you guys for listening. And with that, we'll catch you guys on the next one. Don't forget, all it takes is just one.